This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Race and Jews, Part 2. This time I'd like to talk a little bit about some race-related terminology and concepts, specifically ethnocentrism. The last time I quoted a short selection, a short reading of about social identity theory that Kevin MacDonald had quoted from a man named William Graham Sumner, and I was curious about Sumner. I wanted to know more about him. Sumner, it turns out, was the epitome of what Yockey characterized as the materialist, rationalist, 19th century thinker when it came to Darwinism and race. He was what the anti-racists today call a social Darwinist, a supporter of race science, someone who could see the differences between peoples and that they weren't just physical differences, that they were mental, cultural differences as well. There's a page on Wikipedia that describes him as one of the best known public intellectuals of the late 19th century. This was a man who was well known, very popular. And yet, for all the time I've been working, trying to understand race, I had never encountered his name before. That's one of the consequences of the race scientists losing to the Jews and having the science of race hijacked and derailed by them. That we don't learn about these people and the work that they did and the ideas that they had, except from a boogeyman type of telling of history. And that's what I found largely in, at least in popular contemporary references back to William Graham Sumner. A Slate article from 2012 was titled "Income Inequality: William Graham Sumner Invented the GOP's Defense of the Rich in 1883. And described him as a champion of inequality. But it did also have to admit that as a professor, he helped to pioneer the new discipline of sociology, and he coined such lasting terms as ethnocentrism and folkways in his studies of American culture. He also made a name for himself as a staunch anti-imperialist and principled opponent of the Spanish-American War. As I said, Sumner was exactly the kind of proponent of 19th century race thinking that Yockey misidentified, in my opinion, as the source of the problem with what he called the Western civilization. Sumner was a white liberal who was objective, but not to the point of being an equalitarian or even an egalitarian. He was conscious of race differences. He saw his own race as center of his worldview. And in fact, that's how he defined ethnocentrism. And the bit that I quoted of him the last time was him trying to describe this term, this concept, ethnocentrism. There's actually another contemporary site on the net called ethnocentrism.net, and it's a very small site. There's no description as to who created it, but they seem to be focused particularly on William Graham Sumner, and they don't demonize Sumner in the same way that Slate does, but they do write the technical name in describing ethnocentrism. The technical name for the view of things in which one's own group, is the center of everything, and all others are scaled and rated with reference to it. And that corresponds to what Sumner had to say about it. It corresponds to what I've described previously as group consciousness in discussing Yaki's ideas. It's this idea of my group right or wrong. And in fact, what I would say about morality, which is my group defines right and wrong. And that's very much how Sumner saw it as well, when he talks about morality. This ethnocentrism.net site, though, seems to have an axe to grind in that they write this: the most extreme case of ethnocentrism occurring since the time of William Graham Sumner is that of the rise of Hitler and his hatred of Jews, gypsies, and others. So what I gather this site was created to do was to distract, was to take Sumner's historical work and his definition of ethnocentrism and distract away from the fact that it fits the Jews best of all, and instead transfer the attention to the Nazis. Hitler was an individual. He wasn't an ethnic group. So you can already see something wrong in saying that Hitler is the most extreme case of ethnocentrism. The reality is that the Jews were an ethnocentric race or group within Germany that had risen to dominance over the native Germans. And they had done so via subterfuge, via ethnic networking, boosting each other, and through financial fraud. And to the extent that National Socialism, that was led by Hitler, had anything to do with the Jews at all, it was a reaction to this wrong that had been perpetrated by the Jews, this ethnocentrism of theirs that came first, the arrogance with which they had infiltrated and manipulated and exploited Germans and harmed them. The Jews are the most extreme case of ethnocentrism, even at the time of Sumner. And Sumner wrote a little bit about that, and we'll get into that in just a bit. But the evidence that the Jews are the most extreme case of ethnocentrism is not just in their current power today that we can see very clearly, but throughout their long history. And that long history itself is evidence of it. Their continuity over time, relative to others, not just existing among others, which is a sign that they must have had ethnocentrism, but they've actually thrived while living amongst others. And today it's so extreme, their ethnocentrism, that they're able to squelch criticism or discussion of themselves as a group, including their ethnocentrism. And they do it in part, as we see here, at this ethnocentrism.net site, a small sample of the narrative, the way they flip the blame for the consequences of what they do and their ethnocentrism, their own self-interest. Even when it harms other people, they blame the victim. They blame the long string of hosts that they've infiltrated, manipulated, and exploited, not just the Germans, but throughout their long history. That's their narrative of it, is that they've been the ones that have been wronged. They pathologize the Nazis, white people in general, really, for being ethnocentric, for being racist. They turn ethnocentricity, which is really just a naturally occurring phenomena in all groups throughout history, and they turn it into something pathological when they call it racism. That's a measure of the power that they have, that they're able to change black into white like that, using their verbal skills and having those skills amplified by their money and media, and coordinating their activities as a group, because they are ethnocentric. They even succeed in getting others that aren't members of their group, but are peripherally involved with them, either married into them or half Jews, or just people who would like to be Jews, admire Jews, to echo, to parrot their narrative, to pursue and defend the interests of Jews over the interests of the group that they originally belonged to, or that they also may have a connection to. So ethnocentrism, the way that Sumner defines it, can be seen as a form of ethnic consciousness in much the same way that the word racialism, to which it's related, is racial consciousness. It's consciousness of race. It doesn't necessarily imply that you see your own race as central, but that you see that a race of people can see themselves as central, that this is a phenomena that recurs. This is the objective way of seeing ethnocentrism or racialism as being something that is normal and natural and has occurred in all healthy groups of people. It's in fact good and necessary for any group to possess this property in order to survive. If they don't have ethnocentrism, an awareness, a consciousness of themselves, then they disintegrate, they degenerate over time. So, as I've already pointed out, this idea of racism that the Jews have created and really driven home with their propaganda, their control of media, is an inversion of that idea of ethnocentrism being something good. They turn it into something bad. And when they use the word racism, they only seem to ever apply it to white people. It's really anti-racism is a code word for anti-white, as the popular phrase nowadays goes. It's just a recognition that that's what's going on with the term racism, that it's something inherently bad rather than something normal and natural and good. And it's really an inversion of the Jews' own, I'd call it racism, but racism is associated with white people because Jews have made it that way. Alex Linder has created the term loxism to represent the reality, which is this extreme hatred that Jews feel for whites. I think the term Jewism would fit maybe better, sound less playful, but it's also maybe more ambiguous. When you say Jewism, it's a little too close to Judaism. It's maybe a little too confusing about what property of Jews are you talking about exactly. Loxism is too, but it's unique enough that if anybody wants to search out what does loxism mean, they're going to find just that one meaning that Linder has defined. And it's a real phenomenon, and it does need a word. And that's the emphasis in this installment here, is we're talking about language and the importance of language having to do with race. So I had wondered when I started reading about Sumner and ethnocentrism, did Sumner ever put his finger on the Jews? Did he ever discuss the Jews? How did he see the Jews? It turns out that Sumner not only coined the phrase ethnocentrism, he coined the phrase folkways. And that's because, or that's in his book, Folkways, his most popular book, which was published in 1907 toward the end of his career. Actually, it was the culmination of, and the sort of a collation of his lectures that he had delivered in the decades previous. The Wikipedia page for the Sumner has a section on this book, Folkways, and it describes it as, "The book promotes a sociological or relativistic approach to moral behavior, as expressed in his thesis that, quote, the Moors can make anything right and prevent condemnation of anything." In Encyclopedia Britannica, they have an entry for folkway, which they cite as a term of sociology, and they describe Moors are more coercive than folkways. So they're similar to folkways, but more coercive. Relatively mild disapproval follows an infringement of a folkway. Severe disapproval or punishment follows the breaking of Moors. And it provides two examples. Polygamy violates the mores of American society. Failure to wait one's turn in line is a breach of folkways. So folkways, just to beat the horse dead here, are societal norms, they're customs, informal. And mores are also informal in the sense that they're not laws, they're not spelled out, but they're stronger in that they're moral and ethical principles of a society. Both are forms of and rooted in tradition. They're an expression of culture. In the book Folkways by Sumner, he defines mores right up front in his introduction. He toyed for a while and he describes how he thought that the title of the book might be called The Mores rather than Folkways. But in describing mores, he says, I mean by it the popular usages and traditions when they include a judgment that they are conducive to societal welfare and when they are, and when they exert a coercion on the individual to conform to them, although they are not coordinated by an authority. He makes an appeal later on in his introduction that is based in objectivity and his liberalism. He writes, I have tried to treat all folkways, including those which are most opposite to our own, with truthfulness, but with dignity and due respect to our own conventions. For our present purpose, the most important fact is that ethnocentrism leads a people to exaggerate and intensify everything in their own folkways, which is peculiar and which differentiates them from others. It therefore strengthens the folkways. He writes several hundred pages with bullet items, numbered items, sometimes usually one paragraph, often a lengthy paragraph, and sometimes two or three paragraphs, but most of them boil down to just one. And right toward the beginning, paragraph 15, he defines ethnocentrism as the technical name for this view of things in which one's own group is the center of everything and all others are scaled and rated with reference to it. Folkways correspond to it to cover both the inner and the outer relation. Each group nourishes its own pride and vanity, boasts itself superior, exalts its own divinities, and looks with contempt on outsiders. Each group thinks its own folkways the only right ones, and if it observes that other groups have other folkways, these excite its scorn. Opprobrious epithets are derived from these differences. So that's a little bit more. It's part of what I read the last time from MacDonald, and a little bit more that business about the opprobrious epithets being derived from these folkways, these differences in folkways. These are important. They're not often acknowledged as such. It was really Sumner who first wrote in detail about them. And he gives several examples of this ethnocentrism that he's talking about. In item number 17, he writes, when Caribs, that would be the Indian tribe on the Caribbean islands that Columbus first encountered, when Caribs were asked whence they came, they answered, quote, we are alone. We alone are a people, unquote. The meaning of the name Kiowa, another Indian tribe in America, is, quote, real or principal people, unquote. The Laps call themselves men or human beings. What we see here is what I would call universal particularism in two senses. It's this idea that Sumner is trying to get across here, that particularism, ethnocentrism, is universal. It occurs universally. But it also calls to attention the fact that throughout history and across different groups, everyone sees their own rhetoric about the human race. When they talk about the human race, they're really talking about us. And they're implicitly excluding everyone else. And what I've focused on when I talk about morality and the way it appears today to white people today, we're lectured, we're moralized to, we're propagandized that we're supposed to be purely universal. We're supposed to be create a society for everyone. Everyone is us. We're not supposed to make a distinction between us and anyone else. Everyone in the whole human race is us. And it's not a, it, there's a play on words there. It's a trick using what anyone would normally say as human, meaning us. But in this case, the idea is that human means everybody. There is, you can't exclude anybody because that's racism. Thinking of an other is something wrong. There's something psychologically wrong with you if you think there is an us and a them. There's only us, white people. Two more examples from Sumner in item 18. He talks about the Jews, finally. The Jews divided all mankind into themselves and Gentiles. They were the chosen people. The Greeks and Romans called outsiders barbarians. So he wasn't picking on the Jews there. He was just mentioning them in passing as a group that divided all mankind into two groups, themselves and others, the Gentiles. Item 51, he talks about class, race, and group solidarity. He writes, the concept of a race, as the term is now used, and again, this is 1907 he's talking, is that of a group clustered around a mean with respect to some characteristic. And great confusion in the use of the word race arises from the attempt to define races by their boundaries, when we really think of them by the mean or mode, for example, as to skin color. The coherence, unity, and solidarity of a generic group is a very striking fact. So this brings back to mind toward the end of my series on Yaki when he was really maligning the 19th century view of race as reducing it down to just group anatomy, because those 19th century scientists were just materialists, reduced everything down to things that they could measure, like skull shapes and skull measurements. But we see in Sumner's view of things, reading his own words, that the 19th century racialists didn't think that race was purely group anatomy. They saw things like personality traits and as racial characteristics, and they saw these characteristics as statistical, as based on means or averages, and not being black or white. Now, Sumner also, in his book, it's a fascinating book, and I'd recommend it to anyone. I only quickly skimmed it myself. I did not read the whole thing from beginning to end. But it's full of fascinating things. Among other things, he discusses group interests. He discusses patriotism, chauvinism. And he later on in the book goes on to describe the origins of all sorts of foundational attitudes about things like slavery, abortion, cannibalism, sex, marriage, incest. He also talks about this word ethos. In item 76, he writes, the ethos or group character. All that has been said in this chapter about the folkways and the Moors leads up to the idea of the group character, which the Greeks called the ethos. That is, the totality of characteristic traits by which a group is individualized and differentiated from others. And he's talking here about what Yaki would have called the spiritual. This is not the physical that he's talking about. It's the characteristic traits of a group that are based in the Moors and their folkways, their behavior. Racial character is characteristic. In item 85, he describes the persistency in spite of change of religion. And again, he mentions the Jews. He says, the Jews to this day show the persistency of ancient Moors. Read that as personality traits, or an expression of personality traits. Christianity was a new adjustment of both heathen and Jewish Moors to a new religious system. He's talking about when Christianity was first created. The popular religion once more turned out to be a grand revival of demonism. The masses retained their Moors with little change. The Moors overruled the religion. Therefore, Jewish Christians and heathen Christians remained distinguishable for centuries. So, Sumner recognized Jews as racially different, regardless of religion. And so that's a plus for Sumner that he could see that But there is a sour note here. By item 114, he writes, antagonism between groups in respect to Moors. The real reason for the hatred of Jews by Christians has always been the strange and foreign Moors of the former. When Jews conform to the Moors of the people amongst whom they live, prejudice and hatred are greatly diminished, and in time will probably disappear. Sumner misjudged the situation here in two ways. First of all, he took the point of view of the Jews. He took the Jews as being honest in telling their story. He sided with the Jews in their narrative, their description of the history amongst Europeans as being a string of suffering, that of hatred by Jews or by Christians against the Jews, when the reality is closer to what Linder calls Loxism. But the Jews, what were they doing in Europe to begin with? They themselves had insinuated themselves into Europe, and they stayed despite all of this supposed oppression and suffering. The second way is that we see that it hasn't gone away, this prejudice and hatred, that the Jews express their distaste, their alienation, and even their hatred for whites, this Loxism, more plainly than they ever have. They are more free now to do so. And it is more explicit. We see anti-racism, for instance, which used to be understood as a campaign for equality, a campaign against treating groups of people differently by race. We see it more clearly now as what it has been all along, which is anti-whiteism. And we see it even though there are more non-whites around celebrating their own ethnocentrism, that it's whites that are increasingly pathologized for being too ethnocentric, even though our real problem and the reason why we have so many non-whites among us now is because we haven't been ethnocentric enough. Throughout the book, Sumner's attitude toward the Jews otherwise comes across as relatively neutral. It's as if he saw, again, according to the Jewish narrative of things, the Jews as the older brothers spiritually and religiously of Christians, the forebears of Christians. And he traces the origin and influence of many Christian Moors of his day back to Jewish roots. And he didn't focus on the Jews as anything more than passive observers with no active power. But he did write in item 116 something which could be interpreted as more aware. He wrote about assimilation. To one who knows the facts, such a phrase sounds like flippant ignorance or a cruel jest. Even if one group is reduced to a small remnant in the midst of a great nation, assimilation of the residue does not follow. Black and white in the United States are tending more to more strict segregation. The remnants of our Indians partly retain Indian Moors, partly adopt white Moors. They languish in the moral isolation and homelessness. They have no adjustment to any social environment. Gypsies have never adopted the Moors of civilized life. They are morally and physically afloat in the world. There are in India and in the Russian Empire great numbers of remnants of the original tribes, and there are all over the world groups of pariahs or race maudits, cursed races, which the great groups will not assimilate. One of them is the Jews.